Prevention is certainly a useful tool, isn't it? We look to prevent sickness, prevent a traffic accident, prevent crimes, prevent reality TV show. Okay, well, that one we're not too good on. But anyway, now how do you define prevention? Is reaction more valuable than prevention? Can one exist without the other? These are just a few of the ideas my next guest addresses with his new book. He creates a path detailing how what's right can and needs to be done in the right way. That's the difference. His book is The Preventive State, The Challenge of Preventing Serious Harms While Preserving Essential Liberties. He's an attorney, professor who's taught over 50 years at Harvard, best-selling author who, quite frankly, his list of books he's written rivals that of James Patterson, Professor Alan Dershowitz. How are you, Professor?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's a great question that you asked. Is prevention more important than reaction? And it really depends on what you're preventing. If you could have prevented 9/11, of course. If you're preventing somebody from giving a nasty speech that will offend some other people, no. So we want to ask the question, how serious is the harm that's going to be prevented, and how much harm will be caused by the prevention itself?
Now, your book is key in so many ways because, as opposed to pontificating, theorizing, you combine history with your analysis to create at least the ideas to solutions. And it really boils down, and you point this out earlier in your book, to four benchmarks: true and false positives, true and false negatives. Talk about how does that serve as a foundation?
Well, let me just give you some examples. The worst false negative in the history of mankind probably occurred just 90 something years ago. The British and the French had a chance to prevent the rise of Nazism by attacking Nazi Germany for violating the Versailles Treaty in 1935. They probably would have killed 10,000 people if they had invaded Germany and attacked them and destroyed their military, but they would have saved 50 million lives. And that's not me speaking. That's Goebbels, who said he was shocked that the British didn't come in to prevent. So that's an example of horrible, horrible false negative, a failure to attack an army that was planning to destroy millions of people. We may be having the same decision today with Iran. We may be facing that decision. If we allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, we may be causing the death of many people. The example of a false positive is we went into Iraq thinking that they had yellow cake and they were preparing a nuclear bomb, and they weren't. And a lot of people died, in my view, needlessly because of the attack on Iraq. So we've seen in wartime lots of false negatives, lots of false positives. Another big example of a false positive is after Pearl Harbor, which we could have prevented, which we should have prevented. That was a false negative. After that, we overreacted, and we put 110,000 American citizens into camps and locked them up for 3 years and didn't allow them to leave the camps. And not a single one of them probably would have committed espionage or sabotage. That was one of the worst examples of a false positive in our history. And so often we react to false negatives by creating false positives. To put in simpler language, if we fail to prevent something and a cataclysmic event occurs like 9/11, we overreact. We pass the Patriots Act. We put people in jail. We torture them. So there's a direct relationship between false positives and false negatives. And in my book, The Preventive State, I lay out a matrix whereby we can analyze these kinds of issues in an intelligent and lawful way.
Do you think, too, with the preventive state, you help people understand probably a wrong thought? A lot of people, I think, believe laws themselves prevent or at least should identify overreach, and that's not always so, is it?
Yeah, no, we try to do that by using deterrence, by threatening the death penalty or life imprisonment. We hope to prevent people who would otherwise commit crimes from committing crimes, but we don't do it particularly well. You know, we have an expression in the law: better 10 guilty go free than one innocent person be wrongly confined. But and we do that after the crime. We do that after the crime is committed. But we don't have a similar kind of catalog or equation for how many acts of terrorism are we prepared to tolerate in order to prevent, how many mistakes in locking people up. So we have to create a framework for analyzing those kinds of problems as well.
With Alan Dershowitz, his new best-selling book, The Preventive State, on X at Alan Dersh. He's also on Rumble with the Dersh Show, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. One of the topics you write about, I think this is the one that I believe a lot of people will connect with, and how you're explaining the faults and the positives and the negatives. Talk right about red flag laws, because people think Second Amendment, absolute right. Well, is it always?
It's not, of course, and it doesn't say there's an absolute right. It basically gives you a right to own guns, but, you know, children can't own guns, and you can't own nuclear weapons, so it's not an absolute right. But red flag laws may go too far, because they prevent people from having guns based on very, very, very vague criteria. And there are probably a lot of people who have been denied their right to have guns based on criteria that would not accurately predict that they would use it. What we're basically saying is, better 100 guns be confiscated than even one school shooting occur. And I understand that. And if we were better at predicting, you know, maybe that would work. But the red flag laws today often err on the side of taking guns away from people who would not commit crimes.
You referred to some wartime scenarios.
Yeah.
Is there a difference between peacetime law and wartime law, or does wartime law corrupt peacetime law?
The latter, clearly. I think there's a Roman expression that says, when the cannons roar, the laws fall silent. We have seen some of the worst abuses of the law during a wartime, whether it be the detention of 110,000 Japanese Americans or the Patriot Act. Sometimes it is an actual war, it's just Cold War. But there's no question. Oh, look what's going on in Israel. Israel failed on October 7th to prevent the most horrible killing of Jews since the Holocaust. They should have prevented it. They had the intelligence. They made a terrible, terrible blunder, a false negative, by not preventing it. And then a lot of people think they overreacted by what they're doing in Gaza. I think reasonable people could agree or disagree about that. But clearly, they should have prevented it, and probably the current government will not survive long after the war as the result of the fact that they should have prevented this horrible event of October 7th. But the point is, of course, just that empirically, when you fail to prevent a cataclysmic event like October 7th, you're likely to overreact after that happened.
For you, how frustrating is it? It's not like we're lacking for direction or fences or doorways between U.S. and state constitutions, federal, state laws, judges who rise through the ranks and participants in the process. And yet we see a system of courts and laws that lack consistency, I guess would be the thing to say.
No question. Judges are human beings with robes. Often they're just failed lawyers. Or failed politicians. They're not the best and the brightest in the legal profession, and they make lots and lots of mistakes. And what they want to do is claim power. Considering what's going on now, big debate going on in the country. There was an election about it. Who decides who comes into the country and who stays in the country? Clearly, the least qualified branch to do that is the judiciary. You know, you can say the legislature should do it or the executive should do it. But the least qualified branch are a bunch of cloistered, robed people sitting in their isolated chambers. They should not be the ones to decide who comes into the country, and yet they're having a major influence, at least in the short term. I don't think they will be allowed to do that in the long term. I think the Supreme Court will overrule them. But, you know, deportation is one of the oldest forms of prevention. They used to call it exile. And the king would exile his enemies. And now we're seeing deportation being used in lieu of exile, but it's a preventive mechanism. It's designed to prevent people who are here illegally from committing horrible crimes.
For you listening, this is a totally fascinating book because of what it's put to use as its foundation. Professor Dershowitz, in the beginning, seeks to find a coexistence of democratic values, rule of law, and the needs of a society. And through his presentation of history and his analysis, I think he does create the path to hopefully get through into a clarity versus having it clouded over by, well, emotions primarily, but other catalysts for that. And he presents the answer, which way too many authors and books do not. The Preventive State is the book on X at Alan Dershowitz. He's also on Rumble with the Dershowitz Show. Professor Dershowitz, an education truly in your book and all of your writings. Thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on and for saying such nice things about the book. Thank you very much.